很多。Oh, thank you.
Okay, so the last speaker today is Remus Maguire, and okay.
Thank you. So, after when you pop the light, I can put out something on the board. So, I want to explain how one associates to a Hadamard matrix a subfactor and by using invariants of the subfactor, such as a standard invariant, one gains some information about the Hadamard matrix. So I want to investigate a little bit what extent the standard invariant captures certain properties of the initial Hadamard matrix and can be used towards classifying the Hadamard matrix or the associated subfactor. So, let me start by recalling briefly what is a standard invariant of a subfactor. So a subfactor is of course an inclusion of two unfactors of finite index, M finitely generated as a left N module. And while N and M as von Neumann algebras have a rather amorph and uninteresting algebraic structure, it turns out that the inclusion of N into M has rather rich algebraic and combinatorial properties, and some of this data can be extracted from the subfactor by associating to it the so-called standard invariant, which is a group-like object. In fact, it's more general than finitely generated groups and Hopf algebras of finite dimension, and can be abstractly characterized as a group-like object by a set of axioms, which has been done by Sorin Popa. So we can think of it as an abstract object in itself, or as the invariant of the subfactor. And I want to briefly recall how the standard invariant is constructed. So one starts with the inclusion of N in M, and one associates to this inclusion a new two unfactor by doing what's called Jones basic construction. So this is obtained by expanding M by the Jones projection from M onto N, or rather from the L2 of M onto L2 of N when tau is a canonical trace. So this new two unfactor that lives inside B of L2 of M has a property that M into M1 is dual to N into M. So in some sense, M is for M1 what N was for M. Moreover, this construction can be iterated and one obtains a Jones tower of factors. And the standard invariant is defined to be the following lattice of inclusions of finite dimensional star algebras, N prime and M prime denote, of course, the relative commutants. And as I was saying, all these algebras are actually finite dimensional that follows easily from the finiteness of the index. And therefore, being star algebras, they are just direct sums of matrices. So each of these row of inclusions could be described by using a Bratelli diagram. So roughly, the standard invariant consists of two bipartite graphs and some rules for fitting these graphs together. And the standard invariant is a very powerful invariant of the subfactor. In fact, for a large class of subfactors, the so-called amenable ones is a complete invariant by a seminal result of Sorin Popa, for instance, for all subfactors of index at most 4. And the squares of inclusions that show up in the standard invariant cannot be any square of inclusions of finite dimensional star algebras. They have to satisfy some rather strong condition, which is a so-called commuting square condition, which says that these two corners are orthogonal on each other with respect to the inner product defined by the canonical trace. So they are orthogonal on each other modulo C, modulo their common part. So you can easily see this in the standard invariant. If you look at the first commuting square, of course any element here commutes with M. So if I project it on this subalgebra of M, it still commutes with M, but it has to be in M, so it's actually in that corner. So this is why we have the orthogonality condition for all these squares. Right? Moreover, one can start with a commuting square, as it was mentioned already several times in these talks, construct out of it a subfactor by iterating the basic construction and by starting with a proper trace, a Markov trace, and these factors obtained, of course, cannot be any factors. They are approximately finite dimensional, so they are isomorphic with a hyperfinite factor. And this is one of the main constructions of subfactors, one of the main ways of constructing subfactors. So as you can see, commuting squares are rather non-trivial mathematical objects, since one can construct subfactors from them. And actually, it's not so easy to give examples of commuting squares, since you want this condition here to happen. So let's get to some examples, which will lead us naturally to Hadamard matrices. So for every finite group G, one can construct a commuting square associated to G by just looking at n by n matrices, where n is the order of G, so B of L2 of G, and L infinity of G, the diagonal matrices, and C of G. And it's very easy to check that these corners are orthogonal. Moreover, it turns out that this square uniquely identifies a group G. So the isomorphic class of this commuting square captures G, while each of these algebras in themselves are the same for possibly different Gs. This, of course, is the same for all G of the same order, and this also could be the same, for instance, for two abelian groups with the same number of elements. However, the commuting square captures G uniquely, and I don't think that's actually too obvious to do. You could do it by first constructing the subfactor and then arguing that the subfactor is the cross-product subfactor, so it recovers the group, but just by looking at the commuting square, it's not absolutely obvious. So a particular case of this is when the group is Gn. So in this case, we have here diagonals, and here we have the conjugation of diagonals by the Fourier transform matrix, so the matrix with entries based on root of order n of unity and powers k times l on position kl. And this example suggests, so this is what I will refer to as the Fourier commuting square or the standard commuting square, and this suggests looking at commuting squares of this form and asking for what u is this a commuting square. So we consider just two copies of the diagonals. So these were first considered by Sorin Popa, and for what u is this a commuting square? Well, it's very simple to figure out the condition, and u has to have all entries of the same absolute value, or in other words, after a normalization, u has to be a Hadamard matrix. A Hadamard matrix is a matrix which is a unitary orthogonal rows, and all entries are of absolute value plus or minus 1. So these are the sort of commuting squares I want to consider. So some examples: for every n, there exists at least one Hadamard matrix. As you could see already, it's a Fourier matrix. Here I wrote it for n equal 2, so it's based on negative 1, the root of order 2. And I should specify that when I talk about a Hadamard matrix, I always talk of it up to some natural operations that one can do to any matrix. So, there are two natural canonical operations that preserve whether or not a matrix is Hadamard. So maybe I did not express this quite correctly. I mean to say that when I do this operation to a Hadamard matrix, I still obtain a Hadamard matrix. So that is permutations of rows or columns, of course, but also multiplying a row or a column by some element of absolute value 1. So because of this, to avoid working with general Hadamard matrices which could be obtained one from another via these operations, one thing we can do is we can normalize the Hadamard matrix. So it's enough to assume that the Hadamard matrix has only 1s on the first row and column. Of course, even if we just consider matrices of this form, it is still possible that some of them are equivalent via these operations, but at least it's easy to see that only finitely many could be equivalent with a given matrix. So with these notations, we could say that this is a unique 2x2 Hadamard matrix. It's very easy to check up to those operations. And for n equals 3, in fact, it's also true that there is a unique 3x3 Hadamard matrix, which is a Fourier 3x3 matrix. Now, for every n that is non-prime, there is a way to construct parametric families of non-equivalent complex Hadamard matrices. This construction was first considered by Uffe Hagerup in 96, but in a more particular case, and then in a more general case by Ditzer in 04. So actually this is not Dita. I need to decorate this name. It's a Romanian name, so it has, well, I cannot do it, but it's Ditzer. Sorry about that. So let me explain a little bit this construction. So we start with an n that is non-prime, and we consider some matrices of order, this should be L, so we consider some matrices of order L, K of them, so we can produce such matrices, for instance the Fourier ones, and one matrix of order K, and then we glue them together by writing those matrices and writing the elements of A like this. So as you can see, this is a generalization of tensor product in some sense. If all B's were equal, it would be just a tensor product of A and B, so not very interesting construction perhaps. But like this, we can actually obtain, even if we start with equivalent B's, new Hadamard matrices which are non-equivalent. For instance, when N is 4, start with the 2x2 matrix I wrote here, and start also with B1 and B2 being this 2x2 matrix, and another matrix which is obviously equivalent with it. So, however, when we do this construction, we obtain 4x4 matrices which are not equivalent anymore. So we obtain a parametric family of Hadamard matrices. The point being that if we have a parametric family, we have a parametric family of non-isomorphic commuting squares, so possibly the subfactors constructed to them, perhaps they are also non-isomorphic, even so we don't really have means to argue that at this point. So how about for n prime? Sorin Pop asked this question in 81, I guess, whether or not there exists more than one complex Hadamard matrix of prime order. And as it turns out, for n greater than 7, there exists indeed at least one non-Fourier Hadamard matrix, has been constructed by De La Hart Jones for n of the form 4k plus 3 and Munemasa Vatatani for n of the form 4k plus 1. So as you can guess, this is based on some number theoretical considerations. It's constructing using quadratic residues. However, for n equal 5, Hagerup showed that the Fourier is the only one up to equivalence, and even so 5 is such a small number, this entails a few pages of computation, so you know it's already not at all an obvious fact. So then for this question becomes whether or not there exist finitely many complex Hadamard matrices of prime size, but even this is not true. Actually, a student of Sorin, Petrescu, found mainly using computers parametric families of complex Hadamard matrices of certain orders. So, you know, this means that from each of these, again, you can construct parametric families of commuting squares. So these are, if you prefer, some of the simplest examples of parametric families of Hadamard matrices, which are not obtained through the Ditzer-Hagerup construction. So I'll get soon to the subfactors associated to Hadamard matrices, but let me talk just a little bit more about these classification results. So as I was saying, we have a complete classification for 3, 4, 5, which is, so for 3 and 5, just 1, as Hagerup showed, and for 4, we have that family that I wrote before, which is a Ditzer-Hagerup type family. And recently, together with Karl Beauchamp, we obtained a classification of all self-adjoint ones of order 6. So why were we looking at this, you might wonder? First of all, because 6 is a small number, and we are hoping to obtain an interesting family, which is not of Ditzer-Hagerup type, and so this is kind of the smallest order for which you can hope for such a family, so that you can look at the associated subfactors. And second, particularly in dimension 6, this is the classification question is of interest to people in quantum information theory. Mainly, they are very interested in knowing whether there exists some orthonormal basis of Hadamard matrices, 4 or more. So, can you guess what the answer is for 6? Well, I don't think you can guess, actually, because that's the answer for 6. So, these are all the 6 by 6 self-adjoint Hadamard matrices. So, as you see, they are pretty horrible looking. It's not what we hoped in any case. So they are all based on just some parameter theta, which takes values in some strange intervals. And in fact, we tried very hard to better parametrize this, but we couldn't. So I'm not saying it's not possible, because working with equivalent matrices can yield, you know, much better parametrization, of course. So let me briefly mention how the proof of this works, which is, of course, completely elementary, but still it took quite a bit of work. So let me just tell you how you get rid of extra variables, so how you make your problem simple. So why did we care that they are self-adjoint? Well, the way that helps you is that the diagonal entries have to be, of course, real, 1 or negative 1. So if you have a negative 1 somewhere, because of the orthogonality condition between two rows, you immediately get that the sum of 4 variables of absolute value 1 has to be 0. So you know that's not possible. The sum of 4 vectors can be 0 on the circle if and only if they are opposite to each other. So this gets rid of variables. However, you can have the bad case in which the diagonal contains just 1s, and this requires a lot more work, actually. So I wrote here just a few entries, and what happens here is that we used a trick that Uffe used also before in his classification for 5 by 5. And so if you look at just 2 rows, isolating some variables to the other side and writing the orthogonality conditions allow you to write some relation between x, y, z in terms of those 4 variables. And what's remarkable about such expressions is that their product is always a real number, so that can be easily checked to be a real number. So what happens here is that you all you can get is a certain relation in XYZ, which tells you that a certain, you know, rather complicated number is a real number, but that's actually enough, because if you write this relation for each of these rows and you work with it by reducing by symmetry and canceling out a lot, you actually get a sum of seven numbers of absolute value 1, which is supposed to be 7, so you know it works like a charm, and you obtain a contradiction unless two of the variables were equal, in which case you cannot cancel out x minus y, y minus z, and z minus x, and so on. So this again helps you to reduce the number of variables. So now I can get to the subfactors associated to Hadamard matrices. So let me recall again how we are constructing from the committing square a subfactor. So we iterate the basic construction. Now this is a committing square based on the Hadamard matrix. So U here denotes the normalized version of the Hadamard matrix H. So it's H times square root of N. So from this we obtain some hyperfinite subfactor associated to U or to H. And what is a standard invariant of this subfactor? There is a general result called Ocknanu compactness that tells us how to compute the standard invariant of any subfactor constructed from a committing square. We just have to look at this relative commutants. Actually, I'm cheating a little bit. These commutants give you the standard invariant of the vertical subfactor, but basically this is all we need to know. So we just need to know what are the commutants of Dn in all these algebras. And the first relative commutant has been figured out by Jones in his planar algebra manuscript using planar algebras techniques, and let me recall that briefly in algebraic terms. So how can we compute this first relative commutant? Well, what is P1 is a basic construction here. It can be easily seen to be that. What is Q1? Well, Q1 is an algebra of the same size as Mn. It's a conjugate of Mn by some U1, which is expressed in terms of this U, so we can find it. It's not a problem. So if I want to compute the relative commutant of the Dn in Q1, what I do is I look at this. Now I'm going to rewrite the matrices which are here as a commutant of E4 in P1. E4 is a projection from P1 onto the matrices, so leaves the matrices invariant. So if I rewrite it like this, then you see that here we have a certain algebra intersected with a commutant of a certain projection. What is this algebra? U1 is in P1, so this is just P1. So what we have here is just diagonal matrices intersected with a projection. So the second relative commutant is determined by, is determined by the connected components of a certain graph, because you see we have here a certain matrix which we can compute explicitly, and we want to know what are all the diagonal matrices that commute with it. So for that we need to know how we decompose it in block diagonal matrices. But to decompose a matrix in block diagonal matrices, we don't even care what its entries are. We just care if they are zero or non-zero. So it's just a matter of understanding the zero and non-zero entries of this profile matrix. This is how it's called in Hadamard matrices terminology. And then we can actually compute the dimension and everything we need to know about this first relative commutant. So here is already some invariant of a Hadamard matrix, this number, the dimension of the first relative commutant, and as it turns out, this is already sometimes powerful enough to distinguish among Hadamard matrices. For instance, the 5 real Hadamard matrices of order 16 are completely classified just by this number, so you obtain different numbers. However, in general, it's an open question how to compute the other relative commutants, or even whether or not this is possible in exponential time. And also, it's an open question whether or not you always get something meaningful in the standard invariant, or is it possible to get only the Jones projections in the standard invariant of H and nothing else, no extra interesting structure, which would not be very nice, right? But on the other hand, it would be nice because it would provide interesting examples of subfactors which have no extra structure in standard invariant. So what is some progress that we managed to do? Well, let me just write one more line on the board. So if we look at So if we look at any Hadamard matrix, as I was saying, it enters one of the following three categories. It can be a Fourier matrix, the very simple one for which, you know, we can compute everything. The standard invariant is not a problem. This is just a cross product by a finite group. It could be a matrix of Ditzer-Hagerup type. Or it can be any other example that we know, and we don't have too many of those, but for instance the Petrescu matrices. So one of the results we had was that, well, for all matrices in this category, there doesn't seem to be any extra structure in the standard invariant, at least at the first few levels. So, you know, this is more a computational result. So we were hoping to get something more interesting for such matrices, but as it turns out, we couldn't. There is no extra structure, apparently, for all simple examples that we know. However, for the other class of matrices, for the ones which are of the general Ditzer type, so Ditzer-Hagerup matrices, we do have always some structure, even in the first relative commutant. More precisely, these matrices always yield subfactors which actually have intermediate subfactors, and the reason for that is that because of the way this Hadamard matrix is defined, one can decompose a commuting square into two smaller commuting squares. So whenever we do this construction by iterating Jones basic construction, this middle row will yield an intermediate subfactor. So there is always an intermediate subfactor. So this actually means that we do have some extra structure in the first relative commutant. I don't know why I wrote second again, sorry. It depends what do you want to call the first, actually. So, well, yeah, you know, do natural numbers start with zero or with one? So why is that? It's because the projection onto R from T is always in the relative commutant because it leaves Q invariant, so you always have some extra structure. So this is a so-called Bisch projection of for an intermediate subfactor. So if you want, you can regard this result in a different way. You can regard it as a way of telling if a matrix is not of Ditzer type. If I compute that number, which is a dimension of the first relative commutant, and if that number is bigger than 2, then it's not good. It means that the matrix is not of Ditzer type. So of course you might say, isn't it simpler to decide whether a matrix is or not of Ditzer type? You can just look at it, but you have to remember that the matrix can be modified by permutations and by multiplications with numbers of absolute value 1 and then permutations again. So actually this was also a way of finding whether or not a matrix is of Ditzer type, which has been successfully used already by people in Hadamard matrices. So I think I stop here, but I do want to thank the organizers very much for inviting me and for organizing here this great conference. Thank you. Yes? So no, this is not if and only if. So it's actually not true that, I think that probably you can get non-trivial first relative commutant even if the matrix is not of Ditzar type, okay, in more exotic situations. But I don't have a proof of that.